that was the least of what they did. They opened fire on the people, and these were truly...
日本政府はインドネシアに真相究明を申し入れ、国会議員も
When Indonesian troops opened fire on the crowd,
this is CBC Radio.
The massacre of 100 unarmed Timorese by the Indonesian military.
Imagens do primeiro, photographs of a bloody massacre during a fight for freedom. This is the CBS Evening News.
In the face of the massacre story, even Suharto's longtime allies were compelled to condemn the killings and came under public pressure to cut back their aid to Indonesia. In Australia, large crowds marched on the capital and surrounded Indonesia's local consulates. The European Parliament voted for sanctions against Indonesia, and the European Community later cancelled the scheduled trade pact. There were even open protests inside Indonesia, where student demonstrators were beaten and arrested. Back in the United States, the Bush administration continued to ship weapons to Indonesia.
That's an excerpt of Massacre, the Story of East Timor, the documentary I produced with journalist Alan Nairn. East Timor, or Timor-Leste, would vote for its freedom in a UN referendum in 1999 and become an independent nation in 2002, one of the newest nations in the world. The video from inside the cemetery was filmed by Max Stahl, the award-winning filmmaker who died several weeks ago at the age of 66. To see the whole thing, go to Democracy Now! .org. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
Did you miss the Afro-Caribbean and Reggae Marathon? No worries. You can go to kboo.fm/ACR to listen to the archived show. You can also snag a limited edition KBOO Afro-Caribbean and Reggae hoodie before November 20th to show your support for the music and the programming you love. Again, you can catch the Afro-Caribbean and Reggae Marathon and snag a limited edition hoodie at kboo.fm/ACR.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News. Heavy rains cause problems in the Portland region. The Portland City Council hears support and criticism of its proposed fall budget package. And the Justice Department charges Steve Bannon with criminal contempt of Congress. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, November 12th, 2021. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Heavy rains are causing numerous problems across the Portland area, including flooding, serious traffic accidents, power outages, landslides, and a combined sewer overflow into the Willamette River. Portland accumulated roughly 1.5 inches of rain Thursday, which is the equivalent of a normal month of rain in September. The heavy rainfall is not expected to end until late today, with a flood watch in effect through Saturday morning. Various crashes were reported up and down freeways around the Portland metro area beginning early Friday morning. Power outages were scattered throughout the region, many caused by falling tree limbs. Multiple rock slides were reported on East Columbia River Highway between Larch Mountain Road and Multnomah Falls Thursday evening. ODOT has been notified of the rock slides but has been unable to determine exactly when they will be able to remove the debris. The heavy rains also triggered a combined sewer overflow into the Willamette River Friday morning. Although they have been reduced by the Bureau of Environmental Services Big Pipe Project, the stormwater can still overwhelm combined sewer pipes. The overflows are roughly 80% stormwater and 20% sewage. People and their pets are advised to avoid contact with the river for at least 48 hours. The Portland City Council heard comments from more than 100 members of the public on Wednesday about how the city should spend an unexpected budget surplus of $62 million. The council meeting, which lasted just under 7 hours, attracted a variety of comments from the community and led to some uncertainty from city commissioners about whether the proposed $44 million budget package adequately addresses the needs of the city. Dozens of Portland residents testified accounts brimming with frustration, fear, and sadness for a city they feel has been ravaged by rising disorder and a growing houselessness crisis. Other testimonials from dissatisfied citizens pointed fingers at city leaders in their handling of public safety. In contrast, some speakers argued that increasing police staffing would not help diminish crime and called for more money to be directed at community groups and social services. The budget proposal is part of the city's fall budget management process, in which commissioners consider reorganizing the dollars distributed to city offices during the city's annual budget decision in June. This year's fall budget proposal, introduced by Mayor Ted Wheeler last week, aims to address issues with houselessness, garbage collection, police response, and economic recovery from the COVID-19 pandemic. The Oregon Health Authority reported 75 new deaths due to COVID-19 on Wednesday. The 75 reported deaths are among a backlog of nearly 550 fatalities that were not originally counted because of a reported data error. Officials said the daily death tolls will continue to be higher in the coming weeks as OHA works to resolve the backlog. Oregon health officials also reported 1,033 new coronavirus cases in the state. There are currently 509 people hospitalized statewide, including 125 patients in intensive care units. Since the beginning of the pandemic, Oregon has reported more than 376,000 confirmed or presumptive infections and 4,730 deaths, among the lowest per capita numbers in the nation. One Oregon school district is facing an $11,000 fine for not upholding the state's indoor mask mandate for its students, as well as other violations. The current state mandate requires students wear masks indoors. Governor Kate Brown has been handing out fines to places not enforcing the mandate and other COVID-19 safety guidelines. Now, the Adrian School District, near the Oregon-Idaho border, is facing a hefty fine. The district includes an elementary and high school with about 300 students total. Complaints about lack of mask usage at the school facilities led to on-site visits by OSHA inspectors, who found 4 violations, 2 related to COVID-19 and 2 regarding OSHA standards not related to the pandemic. The total fines come out to $11,000. Adrian School District officials have filed an appeal and requested a hearing for 3 out of the 4 violations, including the one related to the wearing of masks. The Oregon State Hospital is facing a federal lawsuit following recent escalations of admissions delays. The suit has been filed on behalf of 2 people ordered into state care months ago, but who are still awaiting access to the facility. For at least 6 months, the 2 men have been stuck inside the Multnomah County Jail, where their mental health has rapidly declined. According to the attorneys representing the men, one is on suicide watch and the other is exhibiting violent outbursts due to lack of proper treatment for his mental illness. Legal representation is asking a federal judge to force the state's psychiatric hospital to admit the men for the mental health treatment that the state courts have determined they need. Both individuals were found guilty, except for insanity, back in March and May of this year, and ordered to the state hospital to serve their sentences. As of last month, at least 26 people statewide found guilty except for insanity have been waiting in jails for admission to the hospital. One person in Jackson County has been waiting for 283 days. Though spokespeople for the state hospital have declined to comment on the pending litigation, the facility says starting Monday, 24 long-awaited new beds will be added at its Junction City campus. An additional 24 beds are intended to be made available next year, also for patients found guilty except for insanity. The Oregon Department of Justice, which represents the state hospital, argued in court filings that the hospital has had to prioritize so-called aid and assist patients for admissions. That term is used to describe the group of people whose mental illness makes it so that they are unable to continue with their criminal case until they receive treatment at the state hospital. The U.S. Department of Justice has filed a criminal contempt of Congress charge against Steve Bannon for defying a subpoena from the committee investigating the January 6th Capitol attack. Bannon was a political advisor to former President Donald Trump, who has had other recent brushes with the law. In early 2021, Trump pardoned Bannon, allowing him to avoid trial after federal prosecutors in New York accused him of defrauding people who donated to build a wall along the southern border. The criminal contempt of Congress charge comes after weeks of deliberation by prosecutors in the U.S. Attorney's Office in the District of Columbia, who will oversee the criminal case. Bannon refused to cooperate with the House panel investigating the storming of the Capitol, arguing he was covered under an assertion of executive privilege by the former president. Legal experts have said that claim lacks merit because Bannon is a private citizen who has not worked inside the White House for years. In addition, the current president, Joe Biden, has waived privilege on several matters before the House committee. Bannon not only declined to share documents, he also refused to show up for testimony with the committee. The House had voted to approve a criminal contempt referral for him last month. The charge exposes Bannon to fines and as much as a year of prison time. Democrats in Congress are attempting to push back against Republican-led state legislatures that have passed tighter voting laws. But so far, those attempts have stalled in the Senate. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story with the Public News Service.
States such as Montana have passed legislation that could make it harder to vote. Meanwhile, measures at the federal level to reverse this trend have stalled. Four bills addressing voting rights have been blocked by Senate filibuster this year, including two in the last month that were co-sponsored by Montana Senator John Tester. Robert Brandon, head of the Fair Elections Center, says those measures are important because the federal government is the final protector of the vote.
Both those bills, the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, need to be passed for us to make sure that we can deliver on the promise of America, which is everybody has access to the ballot and a right to vote and have their vote counted.
Across the country, state lawmakers say tighter laws are needed to ensure the security and integrity of the vote. Republicans have accused the measures in Congress of being an attempt by the federal government to take over elections nationwide. Brandon says the two bills that have recently been stopped would strike down two measures in particular the Montana legislature passed this year. That includes restrictions on ballot collecting, which is seen as an important way for Native Americans to cast their ballots, and changes to voter ID laws requiring additional identification if someone tries to register with a student ID, for instance. Brandon says another measure that would not be directly addressed in the federal bills is Montana's end to Election Day voter registration.
If there's a problem with your registration, or if somebody messed up in terms of where your records are, you can fix that on Election Day. And that's the ultimate fail-safe for a voter that gets stuck because there's some wrong information or something was put in the wrong place.
Montana granted same-day registration in 2005, but repealed it this year. Currently, 19 states allow voters to register on the day of the election. I'm Eric Tegedoff reporting.
Mend Correctional Care was providing medical service for Beltrami Jail in 2018 when 27-year-old Hardell Sherrell died in custody. Activists say the state should shut the organization down. With more on the story, it's Georgia Fort with the Racial Reckoning Project.
Nobody should die in jail. Nobody.
Protesters gathered at the Minnesota Board of Medical Examiners Friday afternoon to demand the state shut down MEND Correctional Care. MEND Correctional Care was providing services for Beltrami Jail in 2018 when 27-year-old Hardell Sherrell died while in custody. Video footage showed guards neglected to take his pain seriously for over a week, even when his condition deteriorated to paralysis. A private autopsy ordered by his mother revealed he was suffering from a rare but treatable disease.
There's no doctor who has taken the oath to save lives would allow what happened to my son to happen.
Delshia Perry, Hardell's mother, says 55 investigations are being conducted into inmate deaths that have raised skepticism. Nurses from the Minnesota Nurses Association came forward in solidarity with Perry, saying under no circumstance should an inmate ever have been left neglected the way Hardell was.
That doctor failed to do his job. Why should he still be out here being paid?
That was Tashira Garraway, founder of Family Supporting Families Against Police Violence, who says that this case reveals inequities in the medical and incarceration systems.
We are here to say the inhumanity and the lack of regard for human life has to stop.
MEND Correctional Care denies any wrongdoing. A representative for the organization said in an email that MEND provided daily attentive care for Sherrell. A civil rights lawsuit is still pending in court. For the Racial Reckoning Project, I'm Georgia Fort.
Racial Reckoning, the Arc of Justice, is produced and supported by AMPERS, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, in partnership with KMLJ Radio and the Minnesota Humanities Center. Online at racialreckoningmn.org.
Olympic gold medalist Suni Lee said in an interview Wednesday that she was the victim of anti-Asian violence in a racist attack. The athlete made history at the Tokyo Olympics this summer as the first Asian-American woman to win a gold medal in the all-around gymnastics competition. Lee said she was waiting for an Uber ride with friends, all of whom are of Asian descent, when a car drove by and people in it began shouting racist slurs. As the car sped off, one of the passengers pepper-sprayed Lee's arm. According to data published this year by Stop AAPI Hate, a nonprofit group that tracks incidents of discrimination against Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders, discriminatory incidents have become more common. The group documented 3,800 incidents from March of 2020 to February 2021, up from 2,600 the previous year. Nearly 70% of people who reported being targeted were women. A co-founder of Stop AAPI Hate and professor of Asian American Studies at San Francisco State University, Russell Jung, has said the pandemic, along with widely reported episodes of violence aimed at Asian seniors, was likely to have prompted more people to report the kind of harassment they have long endured. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin with guest Peter Maberduck, director of the Public Citizens Global Access to Medicines program. Then at 6, it's Let's Talk About Race. And at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be rainy with a low of 48 degrees. Tomorrow will again be rainy with a high of 55 degrees. The National Weather Service has issued a flood watch advisory for the region that is in effect until 6 a.m. Saturday. Today in history, in 1954, Ellis Island closes. The gateway to America shuts its doors after processing more than 12 million immigrants since opening in 1892. Today, tens of millions of Americans can trace their roots through Ellis Island, located in New York Harbor off the New Jersey coast and named for merchant Samuel Ellis, who owned the land in the 1770s. The quote of the day is from Nigerian author Ola Joseph, who said, quote, "Diversity is not about how we differ. Diversity is about embracing one another's uniqueness." President Joe Biden marks Veterans Day, the U.S. and China announce a joint climate declaration, and a federal court temporarily blocks the release of former President Trump's records to the January 6th committee. With more on the story, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Today is a celebration of honor, duty, and patriotism. Our international cemetery is a solemn place surrounded by over 400,000 soldiers, sailors, Marines, airmen, and Coast Guard men, and their families who have proudly served our nation.
Executive Director of Army National Military Cemeteries, Karen Durham Aguilera, spoke at Arlington National Cemetery on Veterans Day. To commemorate the memorial's 100th anniversary, members of the public were allowed to walk up to the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier for the first time in 96 years. President Joe Biden also marked the first Veterans Day in 20 years that the U.S. has not been at war, paying tribute to the late Army General and former Secretary of State Colin Powell.
Man who was a friend, but who earned the universal respect of Americans and people for his leadership in uniform and out.
A federal appeals court Thursday intervened to temporarily block the National Archives from handing over Trump administration records to the House committee investigating the January 6th attack. A three-judge panel for the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals issued a temporary injunction, giving the former president more time to argue against their release. Judge Bruce Schroeder, presiding over the Kyle Rittenhouse trial in Wisconsin, interrupted the lead prosecutor Thursday to prevent him from asking a far-right political commentator if the network he works for is biased.
This is not a political trial, and I don't know how you would isolate a person's particular politics and determine that that person is going to evaluate the evidence one way or another.
Rittenhouse is accused of killing two people and wounding a third during a protest over police brutality in Kenosha. Vice President Kamala Harris, French President Emmanuel Macron, and other leaders spoke at the Paris Peace Forum.
Most recently and throughout this pandemic, the gaps have undoubtedly become larger.
The U.S. and China have agreed to work together to combat climate change. Unveiling a joint declaration to cooperate on carbon emissions, scientists warn could raise temperatures beyond a 1.5 degrees Celsius margin of safety. The agreement calls for regulating decarbonization, reducing methane emissions, and fighting deforestation. In Michigan, a federal judge approved a $626 million settlement between the city of Flint and the state of Michigan for residents and others exposed to lead-contaminated drinking water. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Alaska Native hunters are stranded for days on a frozen river, and the White House will host a virtual summit with tribal leaders. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. 7 subsistence hunters spent 7 nights stranded at a fish camp on the Lower Yukon River in Alaska. They became trapped after the river unexpectedly froze. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur has more.
With the low chum run on the Yukon River, salmon fishing was almost entirely closed this year. The trip was a chance to gather more than moose for their families. It was supposed to be a 3-day trip, one that many in the group had made many times in their lives. They went down, took 3 seal and 2 beluga whales, but on the way home, they hit a dangerous ice jam in a narrow portion of river. They found a friend's nearby fish camp and remained there for the next 7 nights. The camp had containers of frozen rainwater, a wood stove, firewood, and food. They also had a VHF radio, a cell phone booster, and an inReach satellite device. Hunter Rex Nick was grateful.
God bless the family that had that fish camp.
No one could come overland or by river to help because trails were not yet fully frozen. Their friends contacted Alaska State Troopers to arrange an air rescue. Over the course of the week, they received 3 food drops, and once, troopers tried to land, but couldn't because of strong crosswinds. The hunters questioned why it took a week to rescue them. Hunter Rex Nick said that they would not hear from troopers for whole days at a time. Trooper spokesperson Austin McDaniel says troopers, quote, maintained consistent and frequent contact with the group. The hunters say that they heard planes flying every day that they were at the camp, except the last few days. Flight logs show planes landing each day in a nearby village, except for one day that the hunters were stranded. Nick questioned if, because the group had supplies to survive the elements, if that slowed the response. Trooper spokesperson McDaniel said no, that the group's supplies did not affect the response time. Nick also questioned if, because the group was all Alaska Native, if that slowed the response. Trooper spokesperson McDaniel said, quote, absolutely not.
We perform search and rescue missions across the state. There is never any consideration given to the race, gender, any of those. I mean, none of those questions ever come up when we're planning a response to a search and rescue operation.
Regardless, Nick said that being out there for a week took a toll on the group and on their wives, children, friends, and community who were all worried. On the eighth day at the camp, the hunters were burning the last of the firewood when a Coast Guard helicopter finally came. 13 days after starting their trip, they returned home. Troopers and the Coast Guard said that they rescued the hunters as soon as their resources and the weather allowed. With reporting help from KYUK's Olivia Eberts, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur in Nome.
The 2021 White House Tribal Nations Summit is set to take place Monday and Tuesday. It's part of President Biden's campaign promises to tribes. The administration will host dialogue with tribal leaders on key issues and policy initiatives for Indian Country. According to the White House, the summit is an opportunity for tribal leaders to engage directly with officials from the highest levels of the administration. There are a number of topics on the agenda, including COVID-19, native language, justice, and sacred sites. Listening sessions will be held with federal officials. The summit will take place virtually. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A Colorado program is giving new life to old solar panels. Equitable Solar Solutions is repurposing used panels to help low-income communities access cheap electricity. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Solar technology is improving quickly, so many people are upgrading their solar panels to new, more efficient models. But when they do, their old solar panels often end up in a landfill. Rich Stromberg says that's a waste. Even after 20 years of use, most solar panels have a lot of life left.
These assets still produce 80% power, so why are we throwing them away?
Stromberg is director of Equitable Solar Solutions, a program of the nonprofit Cold Harbor Institute. His group finds ways to reuse solar panels. The idea for the program started when Stromberg was working with a class at Western Colorado University. He gave the students a dozen used solar panels.
And I said, how can we use these assets to create the greatest value for those in our community with the greatest need?
The students convinced the city of Gunnison to install the panels on a local ice rink and to direct the money saved on its utility bills to an energy assistance program for low-income residents. Now, Equitable Solar Solutions helps install donated solar panels on the homes of low-income people who are struggling with high electric bills. Stromberg says this program extends the benefits of renewable energy to those who need it most. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, November 12th, 2021. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Roz Brown, Georgia Fort, Antonia Gonzalez, Nadia Romlagon, Eric Tegadoff, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Counterspin with guest Peter Maberduck, director of the Public Citizens Global Access to Medicines program.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, we've talked on this show about how drugs and medicines are researched and developed by the U.S. government on the public dime, if you will, and then pharmaceutical companies get patents on them and sell them back to the public at literally life-altering or life-ending prices. If you thought that things would be different,